From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to the Best of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Professor Francis Beckwith, author of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people direct to your earbuds. And it's a podcast dealing with subjects that are so transcendently important. Well, today I have a dear friend, one of the most brilliant people on the planet. I've known him for many, many years. His name is Dr. Francis Beckwith. He's a philosopher, and he teaches in the areas of religion, jurisprudence, politics, ethics. He's a professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University. He also serves as an associate director of the graduate program in philosophy and an affiliate professor of political science. And he is the author of some incredible books that we have recommended over the years, including Politically Correct Death, subtitled Answering the Arguments for Abortion Rights, A Law, Darwinism, and Public Education, and the book I want to focus on today, titled Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. And let me say this about this book. It'll go a long way to helping you understand what is essential to know about government, about its laws, as well as natural moral law and natural rights. This book is going to enhance your understanding of politics and Christianity. If you don't have a copy, go to the web at equip.org. It's our resource of the month. It's available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Frank and his wife, Frankie, make their home in Waco, Texas. I've been there many times because my son, one of my 12 children, has a philosophy degree from Baylor. And my son-in-law, Adam Pelser, also is a professor of philosophy at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And I think was associated with Frank in some way or other. Frank can tell that story if he wants to, but I want to start, Frank, by welcoming you to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Hank. It's a delight to be here. Adam was a student of mine in the doctoral program at Baylor, so that's how I got to know Adam.
Well, he is such a great addition to our family. He's a great father. He's quite brilliant in his own right, and he's a great husband. He and my daughter, Katie, my second oldest daughter, they've just got a terrific family, and he's doing a terrific job at the Air Force Academy. He's really making a difference while there's yet time.
Yeah, we're very proud of him at Baylor. You know, we've had many doctoral students graduate in secure positions, and Adam being at the Air Force Academy is something that we're really proud of.
Let's talk about the title of your book, Statecraft as Soulcraft. What does that mean?
Well, it's a kind of shorthand way of saying what Aristotle taught, the ancient Greek philosopher, and that actually was picked up by most thinkers in politics up until really the modern age. And that is, politics is not just about having an orderly society and enforcing criminal law and contracts, which of course it does involve all those sorts of things. It also is about making sure that people are at least allowed to be good, not just good in terms of relation to the civil and criminal law and the political institutions, but being good citizens and good people. That is, statecraft, that is the role of the state, is to sort of form the soul. Now, of course, as a Christian, I don't believe that government saves you. But, of course, living in a regime where, let's say you have religious liberty, or you live in a regime that is at least favorable, deferential to faith, you're more likely to flourish as not only an individual, but as part of a community of other individuals that are flourishing. So statecraft is soulcraft is simply saying that the law, the government, the institutions, the public institutions make us who we are. And this is the part that I think a lot of people don't grasp, is that even if the government says we're not interested in soulcraft, it does do it anyways. It's just the very nature of a public institution to inform people about what is good, true, and beautiful. Even if you happen to live in a nation like most Western nations that claim oftentimes to be neutral on moral questions, the government really can't be neutral on such questions. It's going to, in one way or another, tell us what is good, true, and beautiful, and it's going to shape the souls of its citizens by doing so.
Yeah, and you pointed out many times the character of an individual influences the character of the culture, just as the character of the culture influences the character of the individual. You mentioned the word politics just a moment ago. What is the etymology of the word politics?
Well, politics comes from a Greek word, polis, which means the city. And so it involves, in a sense, the community, and not just as a collection of individuals, but as an entity that is greater than those individuals. So for that reason, politics, at least the way I define it and the way it's been traditionally understood, is more than just, let's say, electoral politics. So we think of, for example, in 2020, we have a presidential election, and it's just about politics. Well, politics doesn't just involve elections and electioneering and voting. It also involves the sorts of kind of informal rules that arise in neighborhoods, right? Or our local ordinances, any sort of association that involves some set of rules that transcend the individuals is, in a sense, political. In a sense, the family is a kind of political institution in that sense. And this is why Aristotle taught that the family is sort of the beginning of the city. It's part of the building block of the city. It's not in itself a city. In fact, he says that it's not a perfect state, because in order to have a perfect state, you need more than just one family. You need a collection of families that have members who do all sorts of things that none of us can do on our own. This is why we have different professions and, you know, jobs and, you know, talents and so forth. And of course, political institutions arise so that those activities can be protected and sustained in an orderly fashion. But yeah, politics is, in terms of its etymology, just refers to kind of the simple word, the city. But the city, you know, is not in the sort of modern way of city, but just any sort of collection of individuals that have a communitarian life together.
You know, politics is really connotative, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people will say, I'm not a politician because of all of the baggage now that is attached to that word. But if you think about it denotatively, it gives you a completely different perspective.
Yeah, it's like when people say that they don't like lobbyists. I joke with my students about this. Anytime somebody's running for office, you'll get something in, like a mailer or something advertised on social media and says, I'm not like the liberal politicians. I won't be controlled by lobbyists. And I will ask my students, how many of you have money in the bank? And of course, they all raise their hand and go, oh, you have a lobbyist. You know, your bank has a lobbyist. I said, you're all students here at Baylor, right? Guess what? I hate to inform you, Baylor has a lobbyist. In fact, Baylor has more than one lobbyist. It has several of them. In fact, I've actually been at the law firm in Washington, D.C., that Baylor hired to lobby for it. You know, it's part of the nature of living in a free society in which we have representative government for people to actually be involved with politics. I mean, what's the alternative? You know, the alternative is tyranny, right? I mean, one of the things that's in our Constitution is in the First Amendment, in addition to the freedom of religion and freedom of speech, is the right for the people to assemble and to petition their government with grievances. Not everyone can do that on their own, so they have to hire people to do it for them. Not to say it's perfect. It's got its imperfections. Not to say that we shouldn't be critical of lobbyists when it's appropriate. But yeah, politics does have that connotation today of being almost like a dirty word.
You know, one of the most helpful parts of your book, Politics for Christians, at least from a personal perspective, and other people have indicated this to me as well, is where you explain what a liberal democracy is. A lot of people, when they hear the word liberal, have all kinds of ideas of what that might mean. And the same thing is true with democracy. So explain both parts, the liberal part and the democracy part of a liberal democracy.
Yeah, so let me just start with the second part, democracy, because typically when you hear the word democracy, you think of popular vote, right? Everything's run by majority vote. And so people tend to think, and rightfully, you'll often hear, you know, I've listened to talk radio once in a while, people say, we don't live in a democracy. And what they mean to say is this: we don't live in a nation that votes on everything. You know, we don't vote on every law, that is to say, as individuals, right? We vote people into office that represent us.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith. The role of Christians in the political process is hotly contested. Citing separation of church and state, many critics believe that Christians should set aside their beliefs before they enter the public square. However, as Francis Beckwith argues in his book, Politics for Christians, followers of Christ have a rich heritage of sophisticated thought and a crucial responsibility to contribute to the shaping of public policy. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, just give us a call at 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
In John Chrysostom's Christian classic on wealth and poverty, the words of Christ take center stage. I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. As you did to the least of these, my brethren, you did to me. On Wealth and Poverty is full of timeless truth, and to absorb its message is to be eternally transformed. What we do for the poor and the downtrodden, those in need of food and water, and those who hunger and thirst for the riches of Christ's kingdom, reflects the ultimate reality of our inner state, revealing whether we are of Christ or whether we are not. To receive your copy of On Wealth and Poverty, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
According to Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith, a candidate who embraces Christian ideals, even if he or she is not a Christian, is a candidate that a Christian can support with a clear conscience. Christians in America have the historically unique power to enact laws that advance the common good and must take this special obligation seriously by using good judgment while voting and supporting legislation and political candidates. This is not to say that Christians will always agree on what policies and candidates represent the best option to advance the common good, but there is no doubt that Christians have a biblical mandate to advance it. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Francis Beckwith in their conversation.
That word democracy, at least the way it's been traditionally understood, liberal democracy, doesn't mean that everything is voted on. It simply refers to the kind of equality that human beings share. That is to say, I am just as much a citizen as the president of the United States. We don't live in a monarchy. I oftentimes tell my students when I went to law school 20 years ago, I called it the great democratizing experience. And what I meant by that was I went to law school, I had a PhD in philosophy, and I thought I was going to just ace everything, and I was humbled. And I realized that I was just one of 50 students in torts class. We were all equal. So that sense of democracy, this kind of like equality that we have, but it doesn't mean that we vote on everything, because that would reduce to mob rule. And this is why, at least in the United States and in the American founding, we have a constitution that limits the power of groups for the purpose of securing that equality. So imagine if we did vote on everything directly. You would have cases where if you had popular enthusiasms, you could have tyranny, right? Because you could have a tyranny of a majority, and that would technically be at least a kind of rough democracy. But that gets us to the first part of liberal democracy. The word liberal really means liberty. That is, that there are certain fundamental liberties that the government is obligated to protect. And we typically think of those liberties, at least in the United States, in our Bill of Rights. But even prior to the Bill of Rights being put into the Constitution, the understanding was that the Constitution was to limit the federal government so that communities throughout the United States in the differing states can pass laws to advance the common good of those communities. And so when I use the word liberal, I don't mean it in the sense of like liberal versus conservative, which is the kind of way in which we talk in our popular politics. I mean liberal in the sense that there are fundamental liberties. And so in a sense, everyone today, virtually everyone, I'm sure there are likely exceptions to this, but today, if a person calls himself a liberal or a conservative, in a way, we're all kind of liberals, right? I mean, we all kind of believe that there are fundamental liberties. To be sure, there are deep disagreements on certain issues. But that's the way in which I explain liberal democracy. It's not simply, at least the democracy part, it's not simply, you know, this kind of 50% plus one is how we determine the law. And in the context of America, the founders understood that that would be just a recipe for tyranny. You needed a variety of other institutions that were not the result of direct election. So we had sort of the federal government, the U.S. Senate, which at the time was not directly elected. They were chosen by state legislatures. And you had the representation, direct representation in the House of Representatives. You also had the court system. Plus, you also had the different states. And so the founders kind of assumed that human beings, if given too much power, have a tendency to be tyrannical. And so they created a system in which they thought it would be more difficult for any one group or individual to take over. And so what some of us today or some people will say, oh, we've got too much gridlock. The founders would say gridlock is good because gridlock means that people will be forced to have to negotiate disagreements in a way that would result in compromise and so forth. Of course, the question today is, have we truly sustained that kind of government? And that's, you know, an argument that people are currently having, to be sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're alluding to this, actually directly addressing this, but we're called as a nation a constitutional republic of separated powers. And as you're pointing out, that has tremendous significance.
That's right. So one of the things that's happened is something called the administrative state, something that a lot of Americans know about, but they haven't really thought about. And I bring this up, Hank, because I think it has a direct effect upon the idea of a constitutional democracy, at least as understood by the founders. Think about some recent Supreme Court cases that were highly controversial. They usually involved, at least the past decade, the Affordable Care Act. One was called the contraceptive mandate, and the other was a lawsuit about the penalty that the Congress had put on those that refused to get health care or to purchase health care. Well, the contraceptive mandate was the result of nothing in the Affordable Care Act law. It's the result of a regulation issued by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. What a lot of Americans don't realize is that most of the laws that are issued in Washington, D.C. are not issued by Congress. They're issued by administrative agencies that Congress gives the power to issue regulations. So think of all the alphabet soup organizations, the IRS, the EPA, HHS, DOE. They'll issue regulations. All these are the result of administrative agencies. And so what's happened over the past 15, 20, maybe 30 years is that Congress hardly involves itself with passing laws, and they leave it to the courts to have to decide, you know, what is constitutional or not in terms of assessing these regulations. And I think that's really bad for liberal democracy, because it means that the laws that tend to be the most controversial, the most contested, the ones that make it to the Supreme Court, are not directly connected to Congress. And so when you hear criticisms of the administrative state, that's what people are talking about. And those individuals that are in those administrative positions are not directly elected by us. They're chosen by the executive branch, and some of them have permanent political appointments. You can literally, this is sort of amazing, you can be prosecuted by the IRS, go before an IRS court based on an IRS regulation that wasn't passed by Congress. You essentially have a kind of alternative government. And it's remarkable. And it's something that I've seen more and more criticisms of this over the past decade or so. And I think it's something that I guess a lot of Americans don't truly grasp or understand, and how inconsistent it is with the founders' vision of a constitutional republic.
Yeah, you mentioned the word constitution a number of times. We often, as Christians, talk about the art and science of biblical interpretation. Is there an art and a science to interpreting the Constitution properly? And are there different perspectives? Some people are originalists. Other people think the Constitution is a living document. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there's different schools of thought on that. The view that I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about over the past couple of weeks is called originalism, which is a view that's associated with the late Justice Antonin Scalia and the recent nominee to the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. And it's the view that we should interpret the Constitution as it was originally understood. A lot of people misunderstand this. They think that it's the view of original intent. And in fact, Scalia himself did not like the term original intent, because his thinking was it's not what the authors or founders intended, it's what the words meant. So to give an example, imagine when the 14th Amendment was passed, where it says that one's life, liberty, or property cannot be taken without due process of law. Then there's another part that says that the government has an obligation to enforce the law equally. It's sometimes called the Equal Protection Clause. Now, imagine that there were some people, I mean, that clearly there were people who were involved with the 14th Amendment who thought that the Equal Protection Clause permitted racial segregation. And so their intent was that it not be extended or thought to make racial segregation illegal. Well, it took almost 100 years, but in 1954, the Supreme Court said that's precisely what it means. That is, people should be treated with equal protection under the law, And even though there were clearly people that wrote the 14th Amendment who were segregationists or would have been segregationists, it doesn't matter what the words mean, not what people intended them to mean, right? Or what they speculated how they'd be applied in the future. So think of another example I use with my students in class. Imagine you're asked by your boss, let's say you're the partner in a law firm, and you're asked by the senior partner to chair a search committee for a new hiree. And the boss comes in and he said, I want you to hire the best person. Oh, and by the way, my son is applying. So when he says in his mind, the best person, his intent is that you hire his son. Well, it turns out, let's say, you don't hire his son because it turns out he's not really the best person. So it's what the words meant at the time, not what was in the heads of the people who authored the 14th Amendment. And this is not to say that there aren't going to be disagreements among originalists. There are, to be sure.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Professor Francis Beckwith in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you Dr. Beckwith's book, Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
John Chrysostom's Christian classic on wealth and poverty is an exposition of Christ's parable of the rich man and Lazarus. The contrast between modern prosperity preachers and Chrysostom could not be starker. For the prosperity preacher, Christ is a means to our ends, leading many to the Master's table, not for the love of the Master, but for what is on his table. The glory of the cross exchanged for the glory of consumerism, a crude commodification of the cross. On Wealth and Poverty is not a feel-good book for a feel-good generation. It is a message filled with truths that transform, thundering from the past with prophetic urgency for the present. To receive your copy of On Wealth and Poverty, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.